cover up afterwards of executive?
What that entailed was after the money had been paid, there are ways for a humanitarian effort to be expended in Cuba that are legal. And it was, well, maybe we should try and make it look like this. Maybe we should get a charity to have sponsored our trip. It doesn't work that way. And you can't do a business deal or a business transaction or a business trip and then say, oh, let's make it look like it's a humanitarian trip.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Kurt Eichenwald, thanks for joining us. We'll link to your piece at Newsweek Vanity Fair. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Today is September the 30th, 2016, the end of September. We're already into fall and winter. How are the roads out there coming up from Grosse Isle, John? John Conroy, our WHFR News Director.
Yes, sir, Jay. They're certainly wet, and at least they're not flooded as some of them were yesterday.
Yeah, I read that some of the expressways, again, were flooded up to the overpasses, both Southfield. Southfield opened yesterday, according to the Dearborn Police, somewhere about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So traffic going at just the northbound side, apparently. But I thought it was interesting that there is a underpass in downtown Detroit under Cobo Hall. And
yes.
They actually had cars that were trapped there, and people had to evacuate, and they had to go and extricate them. So it must have been pretty deep. Must have been like 3 feet or more. I mean, I would think people wouldn't even try it if they saw that much water, but maybe they didn't realize how much water was actually down there, you know, until they got into it.
It's a very bad collection spot of water. I've been by there before during wet times, and not a good place to be when it's a lot of rain around.
Also, those Dearborn Police Department NICSIL warnings. You can sign up for them yourself at NICSIL.com if you're a Dearborn resident. By the way, folks, it's free. And they give you traffic warnings, weather warnings, and you can let them know how frequent or what kinds also that you want to be notified about if you don't want to get everything. I was getting too many, and I can't remember what they were, but I had to go to the site and cut a few off. So if you want them to get on to your phone, they can send you text messages, or if you just want to check it on your computer, they need your email address for that. But they said that there's flash flood warnings, and I always wonder how much flash flooding goes on in Dearborn, literally, except on the Southfield Expressway, of course, at homes. I mean, I think we're fairly high above ground. We're not that close to the lakes, but can be still a problem. Well,
yep. But the Southfield, I'll tell you this, the Southfield is clear today.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Be careful out there, folks. It's very important that you watch what you're doing. It's going to rain on and off for the next couple days, it looks like. A good excuse for me not to cut my grass, although it desperately needs it, let me tell you. Okay. So what we have is we're waiting. That's right. We've got a lot of stories to cover, but we're waiting for a scheduled guest, a Republican, Jeff Jones, who's running for the 12th District, U.S. Congress. And if you say, well, what district is that? What is it, U.S. Congress? There he is. He's outside our window. John will come around and get him in. So he is here, and I think he didn't park in the closest lot if he was at our window on the... We look out in the student center on the student cafeteria. And, if he would have come to our entrance door, I think he would have found us a little easier. But he's coming on in, and we're going to have a discussion, give him his first half hour. Welcome, sir.
Thank
Jeff
you.
Jones. You met John Conroy, Jay Koronek. Yeah. We're live on the air. Just go ahead, sit down, get your headphones on right there. Get your microphone in place. You don't have to lean into that. I'm going to adjust the volume for you.
All right.
But welcome.
Thank you very much.
Jeff Jones, as I was just saying, the Republican on the ballot November 8th for 12th District U.S. Congress. Going to Washington, D.C. if you vote, if enough of you vote for him, of course. And for those that are not familiar with what the heck contest this is, I have to tell you the incumbent is Debbie Dingell right now. And, of course, her husband, John Dingell, had been representative and his father before him from kind of the same district. It's been changed. The outlines changed over the years, 40, 50 years. But it's a district that starts in Downriver. And you're from Downriver somewhere.
Correct. I actually grew up in Dearborn off of Cherry Hill in Beach Daily.
Wow.
So not too far from here. Went, mm-hmm. went a semester here a long, long, long time ago.
Okay. Well, that's our first question. And I do apologize not to have them for you to look at, but you can listen to me anyway, because I forgot them. They were beautiful. They were wonderful. As Donald Trump would say, they were tremendous. They were great, but they're not here. So they're in my head, though, and I'll try to use the same questions that and just general areas of interest that we talked to Tom Bagwell, who's a libertarian, on the ballot for the same race last week. On this show, we try to only do challengers, not incumbents, because I always figure, well, first of all, we only have an hour a week, so we don't have time enough to give people a full 30 minutes. So first half hour anyway today, however many minutes that'll be for you. You're a challenger. So, first of all, give our listeners a little bit of background. I'm afraid the only thing I know is that you're actually a minister. That's your day job. Help yourself to that. By the way, there's also... Okay. Also, if you want to take a swig of water while I'm talking here,
all right,
too.
Great. Thank you very much.
That's for you. and you first ran for... some position back in 2014. Years ago. So
I ran for U.S. Senate in 2014.
Give us a little more background on yourself, and then we'll go into why you chose to be Republican and why you chose to wanting to be elected to a political office.
Well, I'll give you a quick little bio 35 years of ministry experience, 30 plus years of upper executive management. Financial services mostly. I've run my own business, several businesses over my lifetime. I'm 55 years old. I have 11 children and 10 grandkids.
Wow.
And so we love life. We love people. We love community. I've served in a multitude of capacities from the streets of Detroit to the campus of University of Michigan. And I guess I'm really kind of a street person in regards to into that thought that it's community that makes us a beautiful network. And so I've always served in those capacities. I love sitting across the table from people and talking. It's pretty much the type of business, even though I was a regional vice president of several health insurance companies. Most of my business and career was spent sitting at a kitchen table with people, or in a business room, talking about the concerns, the needs of their future. I created a couple unique entities. Founder of an organization called the Selah Says Society, which was based off of my youngest daughter, who passed away during the middle of my campaign for U.S. Senate, and she was diagnosed with leukemia. At age 4, we battled that with 2 years, and unfortunately she passed away several years ago in the middle of that campaign in 2014. Mm-hmm. So that changes you. It changes your thinking pattern. When my daughter was diagnosed with leukemia, we had no idea. We really challenged the process of things, and I had... a very active position with a company, training people, speaking on a national basis. My wife had a small business that she was developing, pastoring a church at the same time. So our plate was always full. But what happened was is I had to make a choice that when my daughter got sick, that I went on a couple appointments after she started chemotherapy, And I realized that my mind wasn't focused on my clients. And the value of what I did was so strong that I didn't want to disrupt their futures. So I retired. I went to my boss and said, it's time for me to step away. And it would cost us a lot of money to do so. But that was my commitment to my family, that when my family member was sick, it was best for me to step away and be accountable to my family rather than to my mind being somewhere else when I'm in front of my clients. So it's been 3 years, almost. Almost 4 years that I've been technically retired. Mm-hmm. And but I have written a book since then. I've developed other things. I do a lot of speaking. I created an online course. We call it Identity Work. Excuse me.
Yeah, well, please. I often choke on the air, too. And I've got my water here, so yes, if you take a swig, take a swig. I think it's very...
You want to share this one?
No, you go ahead. I'll talk for a second. We're with Jeff Jones, who's running for Congress, and his website, if you want more information besides the next 20 minutes, we're also going to talk to him. Jeff Jones for Congress. Again, the number four there, jeffjonesforcongress.com. So the course is about identities...
Yeah,
creating your own identity or unique identity?
Well, I believe this, that every person, before they reach double digits, had this moment of innocence, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, right? And you're outside in your backyard, and you're playing in your sandbox, or who knows what you're doing. Maybe it's snowing, whatever the case. You had this epiphany, and you run in the house, or you run to your parents or somebody, your guardians, and you say, Mom, Dad, I'm going to be an astronaut. Right, and we've all had that. Whether I don't care what it was—a doctor, I'm going to be a singer. I'm going to be on American Idol. I'm going to be a dancer. I'm going to, you know, we have this great thing in our innocence. So, what happens for the next 30 years? The next 30 years we spend, where everybody tells us why we can't be what we wanted to be when we were our most innocent in our life. And what would happen if, in our innocence, we identified those values that made us want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a astronaut or a teacher or a fireman, and we identify those character values, and I believe you have multitudes of them, but we focus on four. So can you imagine this? If you were able to be told why you do what you do, and you found four of the greatest values that were inside of you, and you were able to identify them, live in them, and make decisions on a regular basis for your life, your business, your relationships, based on the values that you have. Mm-hmm. And so now you're living who you are rather than something that everybody else expects you to be. And to me, that's empowerment.
Well, that's interesting. We don't have a lot of time to talk about that background. And your book, at least the title of the book, is it also about identity? Or?
No. Well, it's called Normal is Broken, is the title of the book. Hmm. And I wrote that book during the process of finding my own identity.
Okay.
And so what I did was I took a collections of stories of my life, going through the riots in Detroit to going to Crestwood High School, that, you know, that our school was, all the teachers were fired. Mm-hmm. You know,
I remember that. And dark day for teachers.
Yeah.
And so, schools. Yeah.
Yeah. And then just seeing our communities, my family, my friends, my neighborhood, you know, that over the last 50 years have been in constant decay, that, you know, I've made a ton of commercials out in front of empty steel plants and auto plants, or where there was an auto plant, there's nothing but a field of concrete in Ypsilanti, you know, and here's 10,000 people that...
John knows about the auto plant issues.
I worked at that plant that's no longer in existence.
Okay, you know? Well, I'm glad you are, at least, John. Yeah,
and so, I worked for 30 years at Powertrain.
Well, there you go. So, you know, again, to me, it's... these are part of our community that has lost its identity, you know, that this is how the 12th District was. But things like the 1974 Trade Act and NAFTA and things of these nature have destroyed us and decayed us. And I just believe that our community needs a voice that lives here. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't raised in Washington. I'm really not a politician. And so because I live and breathe in community, people ask me, Jeff, you know, why do you think, you know, how could you be prepared for all the things of Congress? And I said, I've lived in community. I've pastored a church. People don't understand, you know, I'm a 24/7 pastor that take phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning when people are in their worst of their worst, and it's an emergency situation all the time. And so these are the things that I've had to deal with, and I believe they've trained me well as running my own business.
Okay. Well, you have extensive background and knowledge and experience, and perhaps a pretty definite mindset about values and ethics because of that occupation would have to, you know, make you concentrate on those things. You have chose, though, and I completely agree that the way to get things done or changed, the way we have, the constructive way in our society, is to go into politics because it's the political system that it makes the changes official. The rules, the regulations, the bills that are passed, of course, that's what actually is the most effective way to do it. Although it's gotten, the whole system has gotten a pretty bad name in like the last 10 or 20 years as being gridlocked or hyper-partisan therefore gridlocked also. And perhaps not even responsive to or reflecting majority opinions of the public. And I just, you know, we can talk about this, but just one example opinion is, universal single-payer health care. When that question is brought up to the average American, and these are real professional surveys, a pretty high majority, 60% or more, actually want that kind of health care coverage, like the Canadians, the French, and there's good and bad parts of each system out there, but that they want better health care. They want it consistent. They want it paid up front, even if they had to pay higher taxes. I mean, that's the majority of people. Now, they may be mistaken, and of course, when you're elected in a representative democracy, you can differ with and try to improve on the opinions of the people that elect you. But there's so many issues. Well, again, approving gay marriage, we can talk about that if you want to, but a majority of people in the United States thinks it's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they want to live next door to it. I'm sorry. No, that's bad. Bad joke. I didn't mean that, folks. I have no problem, certainly, whatsoever. By the way, once an hour, we have to say that all the opinions expressed in this show, myself and our guests, are not necessarily those of Henry Ford College, but we thank them for allowing us to have those opinions and to try to be fair and balanced to a certain extent about it, even though we're not Fox News, certainly. I'm just saying is that you chose, let me get to the actual question. Yeah. You chose politics, and it's appropriate if you have real social concerns, mm-hmm. and you want to see changes for the better.
Right.
The system is the political system, and to get elected, that's where you get a part of the action. Why Republican? Well, that was the question. Well, why the Republican Party?
That's a great question. And first of all, I'd like to preface it with this: that I believe that party politics is the most destructive force in America, next to religion. Did you hear that? So those two things. The third thing would probably be insurance or financial services. And so those are...
You're two in the... You're already
I'm in the top 10.
Yeah, yeah.
So that being said, you know, I ran as an independent in 2014. Everybody loves you. Just nobody votes for you. No one supports you. So you can't make the changes. You've got to make the changes from the inside out. And unfortunately, we have what we call a two-party system. And I have this little... facetious thing that I say that, it really doesn't matter. They all buy their cigars at the same shop just off of Pennsylvania. So the word caucus, and this is how I learned this. When I ran as an independent, my Democratic friends could identify with me without fear, and my Republican friends challenged me on who I was going to caucus with. They kept challenging me, who are you going to caucus with? I said, I'm going to caucus with truth. And they said, well, no, you got to choose a side. And so even though Bernie Sanders technically was an independent, he was a Democrat before he became an independent.
Yeah, he caucused with somebody, and he decided the
Democratic Party.
Democrats, right.
So when I looked up the word caucus, most people don't know this word, but it's an English term. It means smoke-filled room. So if that ain't the truth, I don't know what is. And so it is a smokescreen to think that that politics actually, our political parties have identified us. No, but political parties have divided us. And so I've chosen a side, number one, to run against the Dingles for 83 years, the same families there. So I couldn't run as a Democrat. And even though there are issues that I have very strong convictions about, but I don't believe my convictions have to be your convictions. Mm-hmm. And that's why I believe that religion and politics are destructive forces, and they divide us across the issues. And so as long as 600 million people don't come into unity on an issue or truth or ethical truth, we'll say, then the 600 people in Washington can keep telling us what not to believe and what to do and get away with what they have. And someone's got to step up and say, enough's enough.
Yeah, certainly there's a couple of famous Republicans that came over from being libertarian. That's Ron Paul, many years a representative to Congress from Texas. But he found it was very difficult to even get elected as representative from Texas as a libertarian. So even right. though he ran for president back in the 90s as a libertarian, he then chose to be elected for more than 20 years as a Republican, and was part of Republican presidential debates of about every 4 years, and last time around in 2012, of course, before he retired. And his son, Rand Paul, who I don't know if he ever ran as a libertarian, but is pretty much a libertarian person, but he's in the Republican Party too. I don't believe that the two-party system is in the Constitution of the United States. It's not there. In fact, there's no mention about political parties. When you talk about the importance of political parties, there's no importance that our forefathers thought about when they were writing the Constitution. So if you're a constitutionalist, still you need an organization. Okay, you need bodies, you need people, you need networking, and to have something already established is a great help. There's no doubt about that. Right. And so, okay, now we know why you're Republican, and now we can get into some of those issues and maybe some of the differences. I will say, too, of course, I don't think there's any such thing as a typical Republican or Democrat, that there's a lot of differences in either party about where they stand on a variety of different issues. So, and I think the old liberal-conservative split has a little bit of truth, but not in the majority case, that it's not, well, I think not it's, so much... like maybe it was several decades ago.
You know, even in faith, I believe denominationalism is so destructive. It puts us all in a box and an expectation. So the same with politics. But there's extremism in everything. So whether, there are conservative Democrats and there are ultra-liberal Democrats. You know, this year, the 12th District has seen something very unique happen, and that is the resurgence of what is now called the Working Class Party. 60,000 signatures it took to get them on the ballot, but they're the Communist Party. And they came and birthed out of the Democratic Party. So it tells me that there are Democrats frustrated with the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. as well as Democrats standing with Trump on a lot of issues as well. So this distinction and separation, again, continues to divide us. And so why can't I, as a businessman or as a pastor, I've learned to love people where they're at, not where I think they're supposed to be. I have an obligation to listen. God gave me two ears and one mouth for a reason. And on that note as well, in a business partnership, I have to listen to what my client, their needs are. And if I treat you like I do a group, then I've violated their individualism. So here I get to, politically, I get to listen, I get to hear, and then I get to try to come to an ethical resolve. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of people panic about, separation of church and state and so many other different issues. But when it comes down to it, I don't think anybody, regardless of their background or influences, would be upset that we taught their children not to steal, yeah. or not to lie, or sure. not to kill, right? And so we can call those ethical truths, or you could call them the Ten Commandments. But if you call them the Ten Commandments, oh my goodness, what a fright that is. But those are ethical truths that we as Americans, see, we're united on our Constitution. We're divided politically, but we're united on our Constitution. So I am a constitutionalist higher than I am a politician.
Only about 10 minutes left in our discussion, but it sounds like we could go on for quite a while. You're very knowledgeable about a number of background issues. Specifically, though, as a Republican, are you endorsing or supporting or at all like Donald Trump? I'm sorry, I have to ask.
I believe that there's a candidate I really like. Unfortunately, he doesn't have an opportunity, I don't think, because he's a constitutionalist. But I really believe that Donald Trump is probably, in this campaign, the best choice that we have to become a leader, take on a leadership role. I can't say that everybody is, one person's more innocent or one person's more guilty. Certainly, when you have a political track record, it's very easy to point to decisions, that have been made. But also, I spent a week in Washington last week going through some congressional briefing, and it was interesting. I can't say that I changed my thoughts, but being there and hearing thinking and reasoning, you're hearing information different than what the traditional media hears, or being involved, say standing, if you weren't in Syria, you're going to have a different opinion about Syria. You're only going to have the opinions based on what you've been fed, mm-hmm. So we have to come to a point where, we read what we read, we listen to what we listen to based on, our own sways, because we like it. It tickles us that way. And so somewhere along the way, we have to resolve to ethical truth and what actually makes sense. So
it's a little bit off the topic, but something I was going to mention anyway later in the hour beyond the interviews. But the Detroit News, who for 143 years has endorsed Republicans for president, has just announced that they're endorsing Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, who formerly was a Republican for a couple of terms as a governor in New Mexico. You don't have, well, let's get into the issue. I just mentioned that, that there are certainly some Republicans around the country and some Republican newspaper editors and so on that are going for Gary Johnson. So it's an interesting, certainly an interesting election time. But let's leave Donald Trump aside. This is about you here, and you're your own person.
I appreciate that.
I can't remember the order I had in the wonderful printed out list, but I mentioned health care. So we're in terms of the federal government, should Obamacare, as it's called, be completely eliminated? I don't know what Donald Trump would suggest to replace it, but that's his opinion. What do you think about health care?
Well, thank you for asking that question. My background is a regional vice president of health insurance companies for about 12 years. But it was prior to the Affordable Health Care Act. Mm-hmm. First of all, I want to say this. What people wanted and what they got are two different things. And then you've got to understand, breaking down, what was the purpose? Most people don't realize over 100,000 jobs were lost overnight with the creation of Affordable Health Care Act. See, tied in with the Frank Dodd Act, they kind of working together. The whole idea was to access reserve dollars. It wasn't about how to get affordable health insurance to the American people, because if it was, they certainly wouldn't have used Mitt Romney's platform that absolutely failed miserably in Massachusetts, that went from $600 a month for a family to $2,400 a month as a family. And I don't know how dangerous it is to say this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I had to make a choice this year, a lot of expenses to run as a politician. And I was reviewing some of my expenses overall, and I thought, I'm spending almost $12,000 a year on health insurance. I have a $7,500 deductible. So I would have $20,000 out of pocket before I actually got any coverage, right? So you know what? I chose to I'm gonna spend the $2,500 on a fine next year for not, and I dropped my insurance for those purposes.
Sure.
And a lot of Americans have to make that decision. As a small businessman, I've had to make those choices. Most of us have duct tape and crazy glue in our medicine cabinet, because if we don't work, we don't get paid. So a lot of people make those choices and decisions.
Well, just let me say that, certainly the there were a lot of problems with healthcare coverage for everybody, and I do think it's pretty close to being a human right. I really think that, along with education, I think that the federal government and the states can participate however they want to, but they have a responsibility in making those things available to people, however
Absolutely.
You're going to work that out.
We need affordable health insurance.
And the Affordable Care Act actually was worked on with insurance companies and healthcare providers who finally did support it, although some of them not too happy after the fact. And it did get about 20 million people some healthcare. But again, the individual costs, they varied, they were high, there's a penalty involved. There's got to be simpler ways to do that. Again, that's why I mentioned universal single payer. That is a concept. A lot of people can get into that. Just the, one of my favorite authors and philosophers too, Henry David Thoreau in 19th Century America, simplify, simplify, simplify. Now, simple is not always the best, but what about our tax system? Are you in favor of something like the flat tax or the fair tax? I mean, 67,000 rules, 67,000 pages of rules in the IRS, that seems unbelievable, and so many exemptions and deductions and credits, and it's the average person can't even do their own taxes unless they want to pay an awful lot of money with no deductions. So what about, let me just move from, so I think
you asked me three or four questions.
On this topic, but we'll move along out of healthcare. But I think there's a lot of people, a lot of sides that would like to see healthcare opportunities for everyone in the United
States
much more improved and affordable. You know, there's nothing magic about the Affordable Care Act, except it does try to answer some real problems, like people being kicked off because they're sick off their insurance policies and things that just shouldn't happen, should be against the law anyway. But it's an unwieldy system, and it still doesn't cover everybody. So, okay, John raised the point and education. So what about federal government's involvement in public education and higher ed? How do you see that?
I just want to say that with 11 children, you must have had some ideas of how you were going to go about educating all of them.
Well, absolutely, and we've used a diversity of tools that have been available to us. I have children that have been home educated. Mm-hmm. I have children that have gone to private school, and I have children that have gone to public school.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so we have really understood all gambits of the question. I really believe that there's a paradigm shift necessary for education. And I know we're not going to have time to cover to talk about all the things that we could, and I would have loved to have developed health insurance a little bit more than what we got to. But education, this is the problem. Teachers should not be pulling money out of their own back pocket to decorate bulletin boards. I'm just going to say this, and hopefully I can do this in 30 seconds. We need a paradigm shift. You can only retain 10% of what you read, 20% of what you hear, and 30% of what you see. So the educational medias that we've been using for the last 100 years has a 70% failure ratio. So, but you remember 85% of what you experience. So when I talk to people about education, I talk to them about their favorite field trip, and they go into great details, and no matter what age, I just talked to a 75-year-old mayor in the area that went into the details of the weather and the person he sat next to, you know, on the bus, and his brown bag lunch, if anybody remembers those, and all those different things.
Of course.
So as we as you explain that, you retain 95% of what you mentor. So we need to have a paradigm shift that we allow children to engage and experience education. It gives teachers the freedoms to be creative in the classroom again. And I believe federal educational systems have stifled and stymied that process. And so, yes, I do have a plan. It's called Educational Renaissance. And
it's on your website,
I hope. It's on my website. Okay. There's some detailed videos for
Jeff Jones for Congress, the number 4. Jeff Jones for Congress.com, Republican for the 12th District, U.S. Well, there's so many issues there, you have a lot of sound principles involved in trying to solve these issues, and I'd love to talk to you for another couple hours, but we'll have to finish up for today anyway, and have people find out more about you either by going to your website, or do you know of any debates or specific public gatherings or even a fundraiser that you might be doing in the next month?
October 9th at 3:00 at a little place called Top Gun in Taylor, Michigan, off of Racco in Pennsylvania. I'll be doing a constitutional awareness rally, and we'll get a good understanding.
Okay. What time was that on October 9th?
That's 3 p.m.
3 p.m., okay.
And then
Sunday.
If you go to my website, you'll actually see my calendar.
Okay,
and so my
sure.
calendar has, you know, up-to-date information on it that, you know, tells where, when, and what's going on. My schedule's full.
It's a gun range, shooting gun range.
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
Top Gun Shooting Sports.
Yep.
Yeah.
I know of them.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's great. That's very interesting. But there isn't going to be like a League of Women Voters.
I have the League
campaign
of Women
forum for.
I'm going to be at the Crystal Gardens, which is the Southeast Michigan Chamber of Commerce meeting coming up. I have the League of Women Voters in Washtenaw County.
In Washtenaw, right? Yeah.
The Wayne County League of Women did not. Do a federal candidacy. They did local candidates.
Right.
Washtenaw is doing a federal candidacy.
Right, because, again, this 12th district was all the way into Ann Arbor, downriver, swings all the way through Dearborn.
1,500 square miles.
Yeah, it's crazy. You can't really go around knocking on doors very much.
Well, I have. I've been walking from the Detroit River to Zeeb Road in Ann Arbor for the last 120 days.
Okay, well, so, good luck.
See me on the road. SEMCOG.
He's got a raincoat, bet, too, an umbrella, I hope. okay, well, and you get the big time 60 seconds here. I hate sound bites, but 60 seconds is better than 30 seconds, I guess. Why should people vote for you for U.S. Congress, Jeff Jones, Republican?
Wow, what a great question. I'm gonna start it with this. It's a quote by Jimi Hendrix. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. And I happen to believe if you review the last 50 years of our community, it's been in constant decay. I ask people this. Would you say that jobs and opportunities are more plenteous or less plenteous over the last 50 years of the 12th District? Would you say that education is producing more empowered students or more enslaved students? And would you say that communities are prospering or struggling, and would you say that municipalities are thriving? And I think when you review all those questions, then that'll give you your own reason on who to vote for.
Great summary.
Excellent.
I think he's been asked that question before.
I think he's heard that before, yeah.
He's ready for these other debates. Jeff Jones, U.S. Congress candidate, 12th District, thank you much. We got through it. I remembered most of my questions. Oh, I hate to do a soundbite here. What about foreign wars and involvement in the Middle East?
Well,
a big question. Okay,
Let's call it Western Asia first.
Okay,
the problem is that we probably would solve a lot of our issues if we lost our dependency on Saudi oil. I'll say that.
Okay. Well, you could draw your conclusions, folks. Try to catch Jeff Jones and all the other candidates for these offices. Try to make a list. I think your friendly city clerk's office does have the ballots prepared that you can at least look at. Go to League of Women Voters, DearbornDearbornHeights.com, and a number of other voting websites that are out there on the internet to find out who's running and get informed and tell people about all of our podcasts for these shows on WHFR. .fm too of our candidate interviews. Jeff Jones, thank you so much. We've got another candidate for a different office, but waiting to come on the air. So we'll have to say goodbye for now. And here's some commentary from Jack Lessenberry from Michigan Public Radio. And we'll be back with our next interview shortly.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Democrats are liberals and Republicans conservatives, right? We usually talk and think about the major parties that way, as if they were two different flavors of ice cream. Republicans are red raspberry, Democrats, blueberry. Republicans want lower taxes and fewer services, Democrats, higher taxes and more services. Democrats are pro-choice, Republicans anti-abortion, etc., etc. But a new book co-authored by one of Michigan's fastest-rising political scientists argues that the way we've been conditioned to think about all this is wrong. Matt Grossman, an associate professor of political science at Michigan State University, is also director of MSU's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, which, in addition to polling and scholarship, runs a host of political leadership programs. Grossman, who's written or edited 6 books on politics, first got some statewide attention this spring, when he was the only pollster to suggest that Hillary Clinton might not win the Michigan presidential primary in a landslide. Bernie Sanders, of course, won. Now Grossman and co-author David Hopkins are out with a new book, Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Interest Group Democrats, in which they argue that the two parties are entirely different creatures. Democrats are a coalition of groups who unite to pursue an extensive list of mostly compatible policy objectives, including things like civil rights, family leave benefits, environmental protections, and higher minimum wage. But while Republicans take positions on all these issues, that's not what defines them. Their party can be most accurately characterized as the vehicle of an ideological movement. 40 years ago, a struggle was going on between movement conservatives and pragmatic, more moderate Republicans like Governor Bill Milliken and even President Gerald Ford, who held sometimes liberal positions on issues like abortion and civil rights. Those battles are over, and the conservatives have completely won. These days, Republicans are a less diverse set of voters who perceive themselves as mainstream Americans defending the values of individual liberty and traditional morality against evil. That theory goes a long way to explain the current campaign. By and large, Republicans and Democrats are not trying to change voters' minds. They're trying to mobilize their own troops. Hillary Clinton is generally seen as having decisively won the first debate Monday. But Grossman would argue that doesn't mean she converted many Trump voters, she merely energized her base. Earlier this week, during a public affairs TV show I host in Toledo, I asked Grossman if it mattered that Donald Trump was once essentially a liberal. He said, not much, since he's been preaching a classic conservative ideological message. However, his personally objectionable qualities have made him a somewhat weaker candidate than some of his rivals might have been. Grossman thinks a Clinton victory is likely, but not by a landslide. He also thinks whoever wins will soon become unpopular. I have to confess, that I find the spectacle of our politics as two hostile camps glaring at each other, like North and South Korea, depressing. But that's what we've got. And the best thing we can do, Grossman thinks, is encourage voters from each party to try to understand the other. If we're ever going to strengthen democracy, we need to start by acknowledging the contradictions in our own collective political mind.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
And back in the studio here, we're live with our second guest, another political candidate running for a different office and from a different political party than the person we talked to in the last half hour. Ismail Ahmed is here, a great friend of WHFR and the Dearborn community. So anyone that doesn't know Ish, as his closest friends call him, you really don't know the community because he's been so much a factor. And I'm trying not to be, you know, you're a very humble person, Ismail, and so I'm trying to be not humble for you, at least in the all of your service to Dearborn and the Dearborn community and Henry Ford College and WHFR too. So if that means we're a little bit biased, then at least I've expressed that up front. But you're still not going to get any more than, you know, we'll kick you out at 2 o'clock. So now give us briefly though, for the people that don't know you, and you can be humble here, very briefly, your background, educational background, family background, you want to mention it, but employment background. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words, Jay. I very much appreciate being here. WHFR is important to me, and so is Henry Ford Community College. I went to school here, so I really feel good about being here on campus. So a few quick things about myself. First, I'm running as Ish Ahmed on the ballot. Mm-hmm. And it's a statewide ballot. It's a statewide office. It pays nothing.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. It pays, I think, a $3,000 stipend for travel. So it's not a money-making effort.
I had no idea. I thought maybe they gave you not only a salary, maybe a health care or something.
Oh, nothing. And that's okay.
Really?
That's okay.
I think that's worse than being a city council person here in Dearborn. But it's very noble. And, of course, you're running as a Democrat, so if people, which they can still do a straight party ticket sort of thing, if they want to. And, do I recommend that? Not necessarily. I hope you can, vote for the best people in every category as a open-minded, educated person would. But I'm just saying, if you are going to do a straight party ticket for the Democratic Party, then way down at the bottom of the ballot, I think before the judges, though, State Board of Ed is there, and Ishmael will get one of your votes.
Actually, it should be on the ballot before you turn the page.
Okay.
So it's kind of the middle of the ballot. Mm-hmm. It's after the president and the federal positions, and usually it's right after your state rep position.
Okay.
So, and I think that's right, because it really does affect education across our state. And from my point of view, that is the most important priority in our state, maybe next to security.
Well, I think if you're not well educating your children, then the future is going to be problematic. It may be terrible, in fact. I mean, they've got to have not only value education, but also specific skills and knowledge to solve problems. A lot of new problems come up all the time. They've got to have extensive background. Obviously, I'm biased too as an educator for more than 48 years now. It's got to be the most important thing for parents and for state government and federal government too, in whatever ways is appropriate to participate in that. I have to ask you, of course, Ishmael, I have to mention, you were too humble there, but Access is, of course, what you founded in Dearborn.
Right.
Okay. So a great social services, educational, and now healthcare organization too. Arab American National Museum, you were co-founder of that, of course. You are currently associate provost?
I now work part-time at the University of Michigan Dearborn. I was, it was a really long title,
right.
Associate Provost of Community Impact and Integrated Learning.
Okay. Community relations, in other words, sort of. I mean, that's very noble. I mean, it's very important, too. But
yeah, and now I'm a senior advisor to the chancellor.
Ooh, senior advisor.
Yeah, I have a little office right next to him, and he comes out with ideas, and we see if we can make them happen.
That's very important. They need a good sounding board. Anywhere. I mean, it's a lot of presidents at different organizations, including business organizations, they don't have that sounding board. And I think that's, because everybody works for them, so they're a little afraid.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about before I did those things.
Yes. Okay.
So I grew up in Southeast Dearborn, right next to the Rouge plant.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather and my father, who are from immigrant background, Arab Americans, were auto workers their whole lives, members of the UAW, and I was an auto worker for 12 years. So I've worked on the shop floor. I know what working people face, and I care about that. And for me, public education is the most important vehicle for forward movement for working people.
Mm-hmm.
It's that important. And a question you could ask yourself right off is, where does our state invest in public education? We're 49th in the country. And I think that speaks to our state priorities in education, especially public education.
That's some sort of per capita status, too. I'm just saying it's not the least amount of money physically, because that would probably be
capita.
Rhode Island or someplace. It's really small.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's been that way for years, especially I know higher ed, which involved in because of Henry Ford College here, has always been almost at the bottom, and that's unconscionable. You can't operate without adequate money. Even a representative who's a Republican, not Mr. Jones, who just left, but we haven't gotten him for an interview here, but there was a story about him, a local Republican running for office, not in office currently, and his top priority is getting more money for teachers and more money for the schools and the facilities. Now, I think, why is he running as a Republican? I've never heard that from a Republican. Could he really do that? But I've got a flip-flop. I totally believe that money is not a solution per se, but money well spent will be. But if there's no money, then you can't do hardly anything. That's a flip-flop of it. You go ahead.
So from my point of view,
mm-hmm.
I think money is part of the solution, but it's not all of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do we fund at a very low level, and not only don't we compensate teachers and administrators and principals and people who do the work on the ground to educate our children, but we've begun to demean them in the culture, and that's just wrong. They are the people that move us ahead, and they need to be respected. Not all teachers are perfect. Not all administrators are perfect. But it's important that not only do we provide good basic wage and benefits to them, but also we have to honor them for the work they do. My wife, Margaret, is a teacher. She works for the Dearborn Schools, and she runs parenting programs system-wide. She works her butt off. And she needs to be respected for that. I respect her, and the legislature should respect her as well. Finally, I think the formula that we fund our districts is just wrong, too. It doesn't take into consideration the special needs of every district. So there should be a level of funding that assures good quality education in every school, if handled right. But in addition to that, there should be a formula. For instance, in the Detroit schools, where 30% of the population have physical and learning disabilities, we need to invest in those young people who have disabilities. If there are transportation problems that cannot be solved, that we need to be part of that answer as well. So I think the formulas have to change. And we're not doing that at this point, again, I believe, because of the far-right legislature that we have. So dollars are important, but also I think the way we deal with teachers, education, and evaluation of progress also needs to be looked at. Let's take, for instance, the evaluation of teachers. The point of an evaluation should be to say, how are you doing? Helping them to understand how they're doing, and then supporting them, training them, and strengthening them if they're not making the grade to move ahead. It shouldn't be a punitive system. Mm-hmm. And that's what the legislature has been moving more and more toward. I think that's true of tests, too.
I don't know how they do it in Dearborn. Hopefully it's more fair, but I always talk about my daughter, who's a seventh grade teacher and has been for close to 20 years now in Southfield Public Schools, but she's very demoralized, very upset with their educational system there. And each year approaching fall, they don't know who the principal is going to say, you're out.
Right.
Because it's not seniority, and it's not the assessment test or accountability, and there's not necessarily any warning. Mm-hmm. She believes that a great teacher they lost last year just because the principal chose them to be gone. And there has to be accountability at all levels and so on. I have to focus on this. We have only 10 minutes left in the interview, though, but the Michigan State Board of Education doesn't really have any direct power to enact legislation like increase funding. Mm-hmm. So it's not purely advisory. I mean, there's a lot of functions and things that the Michigan Department of Education actually does. Assessment and resources for teachers and school districts. I went to the website. Again, that's mi.gov/MDE, Michigan Department of Education. And there's actually a lot of helpful services there. But many other states have state board of eds that actually can almost write legislation that will go directly to the legislature. They have more effective power. So it's a real problem. You obviously are a great spokesperson and community liaison for the group, and I think that would help on the State Board of Ed. You know some politicians probably, too, that you could talk to.
On both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, yeah.
The advantage, I think, well, let me just say that the job of the board is to create policy statewide on education, and that's an important role. An additional role I believe that they should have, and some do this and some don't, is to use the state board as a bully pulpit for change and progress and to assure that the eye of the public is on both the legislature and everything else related to education. So the two things it does is create policy, and the other thing that it does is that the superintendent, the state superintendent, reports to them. And that doesn't mean they hire and fire. What it means is they hire and fire the state superintendent. And the relationship between the board and superintendents has been different with each superintendent. Brian Winston,
formerly from Dearborn, right? Dearborn superintendent of public schools down
right
here,
mm-hmm, is a person I know, I respect, and he respects the board. Mm-hmm. They work as a team. But in addition, I ran the Michigan Department of Human Services. Now it's the biggest cabinet position in state government. And adjacent to that was the Department of Education and the Department of Health. And we worked very closely together. Now, when governors change, the top three people change.
Right, of course.
Or four.
Yeah, because they
appoint
them.
But the rest of the people are still there. Right. The department heads, the people who make the real decisions.
Unless there's budget cuts by the state, so you have to fire somebody to make the departments. So you're very familiar with the inner workings.
So I know those people.
That's right.
And I know how to work with them. Mm-hmm. And also when I ran the department, I didn't just work with Democrats. Mm-hmm. I worked very closely with Republicans, and we got things done. So, yes, we don't have control of the budget, but also I have the ability, I think, to talk to people, to work with them, no matter what their political persuasion is, because I believe most people, no matter what party, believe in things, care about things, and want to do the right thing. And so the trick is to find out what they care about and make that part of the agenda and talk to them to make progress. So I feel I can get a lot done. I know the rest of the board pretty well, both Democrats and Republicans, and can work with them as well.
Just let me get to a practical issue about voting. I think people have two votes for State Board of Ed possible out of all the different candidates from different political parties. And so it's not just Democrat and Republican, but it's a few others also on there. And it's just interesting to me, I'll just mention that the other Democrat, since you're running as a Democrat yourself, the other Democrat, John Aston.
Austin,
yes. He had a very nice supportive editorial done by Jack Lessenberry in the Metro Times this week. He was talking, John, I guess, had issued a statement in the last week or so for the State Board of Ed, from the State Board of Ed, in regard to gender identity in the public schools and how that should be respected and supported in terms of bathrooms or whatever. It's so crazy to me that this has to get that far, but and it takes a little political courage, I guess, to get involved in any of those issues, even though I guess Mr. Aston, is he's also not being paid, right?
No, so. He's not being paid, and he's a very brave man.
Well, they can't fire him, technically, or take away his money because he has getting no money. Okay,
but he's running for office again.
He is again, yes.
And so he is willing to stand up for, I believe, what's right. We're running in tandem. I would ask people to not only vote for me, but also John Austin. I think he and many of the other people on the board are really well-intended and working hard. There are a couple issues that I want to mention real quickly. One of them is this bathroom issue.
Okay.
They're
right around the hallway here.
Yes.
If you're interested.
And I will use them after I leave.
Please. And you can either one if you want to. I don't know. Go ahead. But yes, go ahead.
But I think it's ridiculous that our two Republican opponents make that the centerpiece of their platform. Look, there have been transgender and gay people using the bathrooms of their designation and forever. There have never been incidents related to this. It's a non-issue to take your eyes off of other issues. Who controls our schools? Putting the public back into public schools so that parents and teachers and local elected officials have a greater voice in governance again. The legislature has taken those away. Funding of schools. And they've gotten so ridiculous that they are now calling for open carry of weapons at the high school level. That means students and teachers. I really believe that that is a dangerous choice and one we need to stand up against. So I really think that this is an important election. And finally, I'd like to say one other thing. And that is, I believe that this is an election for the heart and soul of America. Not just this office, but all of the offices. You know, each year, each election, they tell you, the wolf is coming, he's at your door, vote for me. And so when the wolf is actually at your door, when you have people running for the highest office who don't believe that Muslims or Arabs or gay people or women or African Americans or working people, I can go on the list, don't have a place in America, we really need to stand up and fight that. Mm-hmm. So I would urge everyone to vote, no matter how you vote. This is really an important election.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm going to let you say a few more things, too. I've got just a couple of minutes left. In terms of voting, folks, I think I said on the last show that you have until October 7th. You actually have until October 11th to register. If you're not registered, you have until October 11th. I think that's because Columbus Day falls on a Monday, and perhaps the city clerk's office is closed on that Monday. In any event, yes, the election is November 8th, but you do have until October 11th to register. And on that issue, again, if you're young or even older and you haven't registered and you say, there's nobody I really want to vote for, well, maybe you will discover someone, maybe after listening to this hour at WHFR, but maybe in a couple of weeks even. And if you're not registered, you can't decide at the last minute to vote for anyone. So it doesn't hurt. It doesn't cost any money. It takes maybe 15 minutes to go to the city clerk's office. You need to be registered. And then, by all means, vote, but do everything you can. Listen to the WHFR journal podcasts that are on our website with our candidate interviews. Go to League of Women Voters, DearbornHeights.com, their website. Find out about the candidates. Find out about Ismail Ahmed, and who nicknamed Ish. Okay. And you might see that you have big signs that just say Ish only on them. Yeah, okay. If you're concerned about representation of Dearborn to the state, Ishmael can easily done that. He always does that, along with being concerned about the state and state issues. Again, he was head, I didn't mention earlier, the head of the Department of Social Services under Jennifer Granholm's administration. 3 years of suffering. I mean, it was tough trying to make the money go forward. You had some initiatives on poverty and so on.
It was worth it. We brought in over $2 billion extra dollars of federal money that helped people with food stamps and foster care. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason I was attracted is that you can help millions of people with little things. And so, yeah, it's not the most fun job in the world. And this probably won't be either. But the truth is that you have to stand up and work hard for the things you believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly wish you the best at getting your full message. And a lot of times candidates for State Board of Ed, they don't really let you know what they stand for on the issues. They're not willing to stand up and be countered, if you will. They just hope you recognize their name. Ishmael has a lot of information out there. It's Ismail. Again, his nickname is Ish, but his first name is actually Ismael, Ismail, for board.com. Okay, and that's... For F-O-R, a lot of candidates just using the number 4. So Ismael, ISMAELFORBORD.com. Are you going to be any candidate debates or fundraisers in the next few weeks that you want to mention? It's probably on your website, though.
If you go to the website, you can see all of the fundraisers that we have. I just finished in a debate, and I'm not sure we're going to have any more, but I'd love to do more.
They don't often schedule debates among the State Board of Ed candidates, which is unfortunate, but well, I wish you the best in getting your message out. I think your name's out there in Durham, but as you said, it's a statewide thing.
It's a big state.
You're going to go knocking on doors in Traverse City, or no, probably not.
I am.
Really? Okay.
Because I'm going to be the only Arab American on the statewide ballot, and I want to... people to know that I am more than just my ethnicity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, if you don't know, you can't choose the best, folks, and we'll let you make those decisions. It's a crazy 60 seconds at the end, but why should people vote for you for State Board of Ed? Just sum up that whole last half hour if you can.
Well, simply said, because I believe in public education, and I will do everything to assure that every person in this state gets a wonderful public education, and I will fight for that.
Thank you so much. Ismail Ahmed, State Board of Education on the Democrat Party side. Consider all the candidates. Find out as much as you can about all of them. We'll be back again next week. Thank you, John Conroy, for being here today, because I forgot my question list. I couldn't toss any over to you. We'll be back again next Friday. Yeah, coming up Highway 61, we got to continue with our great program at WHFR. Tell your friends about our podcast at